particularly, and she said that he turned very red when he read it, and she begged me not to send that letter. I don't know how I could ever have listened to my mother. I knew my mother was a stupid woman and didn't know anything. How could I have done it? And what kind of a pride did I have to be injured? But I didn't know enough. I didn't know enough to write and even tell him I'm sorry. He wrote an answer. He said, "Well, I'm sorry it meant so little to you. You don't care if I ever come or not, so I won't come."
So you were just thought you would be staying, living at home until somehow you got married. That was your plan.
Well, then there was. I went to a Hungarian dance with the daughter of this man that I told you was the best, and yet Nellie. They came to this country from Russia, and she was 11 years old, and she was very pretty. See, I was so envious of her. And I taught her English. I taught her how to read books and everything. Then she went to school, and she went up to the 7th grade. And you know now she's a millionaire. She married Jesse Schrader from the Schrader Kronsteiner Samson Luggage. She's a millionaire. And he hands over and everything. You know, it's funny how things intertwine and everything. But I remember after I wrote the letter, and then I got that letter from him, from Louis. I was so unhappy. You know, I went down to 98 pounds. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. And yet I didn't know how to go ahead and say, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it." I didn't know how. And it probably altered my whole life. So when that Hungarian dance we went to, I met many of the Hungarians, you know, and so Joe Rosenblum, who was Dorothy's father, he taught me the child. He came over, and I don't know why he was attracted to me when Nellie was there with me, and Nellie was so pretty, and I never was. But he did like me, and he taught me the child dress and everything, and he used to come over quite often. We were both 19. He was only 3 weeks older than I was. He taught me the chadash and everything. And then when I was 20, I went to St. Louis to visit my brother. They had a baby by that time. He had been married. And that's when the terrible earthquake in San Francisco took place. And when I came back, Joe came to see me all the time. And then once he said to me, "You know, I like you as much as I like my sister, Regina." I said, "Well, that's nice of you." He said, "You know, as a matter of fact, I like you a whole lot more than I like my sister." I said, "Well, that's a little bit better." So he says, "Let's get married." I said, "Well, you know," he was supporting his whole family. They were all living on him.
What was he doing?
He was a waiter. And that also I thought was terrible, to be a waiter. I didn't think that much anything, if you were a printer, anything, but to be a waiter, where you wait for tips, I thought that was terrible. But he said he would learn to do something else, but he never had a chance with that father. His father was a Schauspieler, a German actor, and they all spoke Hungarian, because they were born in Budapest, and they all spoke Hungarian. But my mother-in-law, who was even more of a shrink than I am, she was shorter than I am, you can imagine. She didn't speak Hungarian, just Hochdeutsch and German. Well, German, Hochdeutsch. But they all spoke Hungarian.
Now, when did you marry then, Barbara?
In 1907, when I was almost 23.
Between the time that you went to that first socialist meeting when you were 16 and the time you married, were you getting more political and more involved?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I became, from the time I first heard Skip Wilson, I thought that was the answer. Socialism was the answer. And to me, socialism really was just tremendous.
What sort of things did you start reading then in the socialist literature?
Well, I read the little books put out by from Chicago,
those little blue books.
Yes, yes, I read those, and they were to me just fascinating. And when I read the manifesto, that became my Bible. You know, I can't.
You read Marx when you were very young then.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's all I read of Marx, was the manifesto. But that to me, every paragraph, every sentence almost was so full of meaning. And then a specter is haunting you, the specter of communism. And then he says, the history of all hitherto existing the society is the history of class struggle. It just opened up a new world to me. It just...
Now, did you get involved with other people, or were you just...
Well, in Denver, the people I knew around me knew, none of them were socialists or anything that I knew of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, and I met a group, you know, that were more... I went to their meetings. I went...
Where was that?
In Denver. And that was about... I think it was just before I was married. And I went to all the picket lines, and I went to every meeting they had, and tried to see just what. But I tell you who I met and liked tremendously were the IWW.
I was just going to ask you, because this is about the time period that the Western Federation of Miners were active in Colorado and the
Lovelies. Yes. And they, you know, my warmest friends and the people I liked the most of all were the IWW.
Did you? But you did not consider yourself an anarchist. Did you consider yourself an anarchist?
When they had their socialist meeting every Sunday at Howe Hall, and there I met a character by the name of Paulson, an old Scotsman who was a Marxist, and he told me so much, you know, of what he knew about the... He told me of the Western Federation of Miners and told me of what was happening. And then, well, it just seemed that... And I met so many of them, you know, and I loved every one of them, every one of those IWW. I remember, you know, from the lowliest worker to the highest intellectual, they were IWW. And I remember when I heard Henry George, who said, not Henry George, but his name was George, I forget now. He wrote the songs for the IWW, and he said, in Chicago's deepest dungeons for the OBU, remember you're out there for us while we're in here for you. They just stirred me to so much.
Did you go to art? Did you go to the Wobbly meetings in Denver?
No, I never went to a work. I never
did
knew
where. Meetings for individuals?
Yes. Just individuals. When I met them at the I met many of them at the socialist meetings. They came to the socialist meetings, you know.
And most of those were involved with the Western Federation of Miners at that time?
Well, they knew about them and they had help. They contributed. They got money and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but everything. It wasn't until 1915 that I heard about Joe Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I joined the Socialist Party. I heard Kate Richards O'Hare.
That before she went to jail, this was?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, because it was just before we went into the war. She was one of the most magnificent speakers, the most dramatic that I ever heard in my life. And then she told us the things, you know, that she said, you people here, if you think that what's happening in St. Louis and everything doesn't affect you, you are wrong, because the disease they pick up when your daughters there have to sell their souls into prostitution in order to live, to eat, they come back with the disease that gives it to your sons. So you better know that it's one struggle for all.
Now, Barbara, this was already later. How about when you were married, you were beginning to go to socialist meetings, though?
Yes.
Now, was your husband involved with the socialist
meetings? Well, he had never even heard about them until we were married. And he had been really kind of quasi-religious, not religious. But when I told him, read the Bible, how can you believe in such bunk? And he began to read the Bible, and he was almost worse than I am, pointing out, look, do you know what the Lord always does? Tell him to kill and everything. And he became an atheist, all right, and everything. But he never joined the Communist Party. And he said, you know, you're not even acting like Marx said. Marx said, workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains, but you have something to lose. I says, what, for instance? He says, you're a son of going to university, and you live in a beautiful home, but a fairly comfortable home in a fairly decent neighborhood and everything. So he says, when I lose my job and I have nothing, I'll wave the red flag and I'll do everything too. But right now I can't sing. I'd only lose my job. That I can do.
So he was nowhere near as active or political as you were then.
No, but he never was against it. Only, he didn't want me to be that active. He was always afraid. I was only arrested one time. And the one who tried to save me was Anita Whitney.
Oh, so that was in California already, though.
Yes. Oh, yes. We came to California in 1921, November the 17th, 1921.
Now, how soon was your first child born after you were married?
She was born about 11 months after I was married, August the 2nd.
Now, how many children did you have?
She died when she was 4 years and 7 months old. I had 3 children in 2 years and 7 months. But when Helen died, something died. She was a remarkable little girl. As young as she was, she knew about socialism. She'd heard me talk and everything.
Now, did you know anything about birth control?
I read Margaret Sanger, and I did whatever Margaret Sanger did, but it didn't do me one bit of good. Not a thing.
Because it was usually the radicals in the early days who did know a little bit about birth control.
Well, I did whatever Margaret Sanger did. That's about all I did know.
Well, did you use the sponge, or did you
yes, you always say, yes, I used the sponge. We always say that Frances, who was the third one, and she ought to be very refined because she came drained through a fine silk sponge.
And how did you find out about the sponge? Because this would be a little early for Margaret Sanger in 1907.
Well, I read a book by a Dr. Stockham, a woman doctor from Utah. And that was a revelation to me, you know, because I even knew very little about sex or anything, very little. And where she said the various forms of birth control, and she said, some use this sponge, you know. And I got that little silk sponge, but it didn't help me at all.
Did you talk about it with the other radical women? Or is it something that you never even talked about?
You see, very few at that time. Remember, that long time ago, over 50 years ago, people didn't talk about sex or about things very openly. It was very rarely. Once in a while, you got some brave soul who did tell you more about it, you know, but not very often. And the first thing I knew anything about sex at all was I was about 17, and one of the gold hammers in Denver, who was one of the wealthier Jews, you know, and he went to college, but he was an awful fool. He didn't have much sense. But he gave me the Book of Nature, it was called. And some of the things, you know, they told you about the fallopian tubes and this and that and all that and everything, which was just absolutely news to me. I didn't even know where the baby came from. We'd had a cow, and I saw a calf born. Well, you know, the cow, the anus is very close to the... I thought that first came from. It was a Hungarian woman who spoke only German. When I was, just before my first child was born, she said, you know, Barbara, you really know so little about anything. I never met anyone as ignorant as you. Where do you think your child will come from? I said, I don't know. She said, well, the same way it was put in. I never forgot what she said. But how can it come from such a small place? She said, that's why you have so much pain. It has to stretch and everything. And I did have.
Was your first child born at home? Or
at home.
With a midwife or a doctor?
A doctor. I had to have 2 doctors because she came with, the face came with her and she couldn't be born. So they had to call in a specialist, you know, and he dilated it or whatever he did anyway.
So during this time period, for instance, this book by this Dr. Sarkar, how did you find out about that? Was it from the other radicals or something that you just learned on
about
your
About the what?
The sponge and this book by this Dr. Sarkar.
Yes, it would be about some of the more radical women, you know, and everything. You see, I joined the Socialist Party in 1915, when Dorothy was 1 year old. And then in Denver, you know, when we went to Socialist meeting, my husband once said they were arresting people, you know, very much, very. So he said, he came home once and he said, "You'll have to quit the Socialist Party." I said, "Never." He said, "Well, you'll have to choose between the Socialist Party or me." And I said, "Well, that's easy. That's for you." And I chose the Socialist Party.
So you left him then?
I didn't leave him. He didn't leave either. He got stabbed out of the house and was very angry. But he came back in a few hours. And 3 days later, when, you know, he came home and got me a red rose, he said, "You know, as I passed the florist, this red rose just beginning to bud. You know how you love those red roses. I thought you'd like it." I said, "How very sweet of you, Joe." "Yes, I do. I love them. Thank you." He never again, the next Sunday, he said, "Kid, do you want to go to the Socialist Party meeting with Mama?" Never
again.
But he
didn't go with you?
Yes, he did.
He did too?
Yes, he did. But he never joined.
Uh-huh. Was it mainly fear because of the political repression that was beginning
well,
to
Well, yeah, that's right. That's the whole thing, because he believed in it. He believed in it, and he had become a very ardent atheist, you know. So,
what sort of activities did the socialists engage in?
We went on the picket on the went on picket lines. And I remember.
Was it for industrial strikes?
Yes, we went on picket lines. I remember when the war first started in Europe, you know. In 1914 and everything, and we went to the German Turnhalle. See, at that time, Germany was not like under Hitler. At that time, the Germans, most of them were socialists, really. Mm-hmm. And they're very different people. And we went there, and I remember when one Jewish radical got up and said, "You know, we've got to learn to use guns, and let's give them the guns." And one of the socialists got up and says, "Throw that provocateur out. He is nothing but a provocateur. God damn him to hell. Throw him out." And the whole bunch of socialists got up, you know, picked the guy up and threw him out of the house. And they did send provocateurs into the everything.
But how large was the socialist group in Denver?
It was quite large, you know. I don't, the group I belonged to had about 40 members.
Mm-hmm.
And
were there many women in it?
Yes, more women than men as far as that's concerned. But they were quite militant, and we always supported the Socialist Party. Then, of course, the Socialist Party split at that time between the Hillquit and the other. Now, one supportive thing, see, Dorothy asked me, what did I think was the most remarkable thing that struck me as the greatest thing that ever happened? I said, the Russian Revolution. I think that to me was one of the most marvelous things that could have happened. Because here was a regime of such utter cruelty, bestiality, the strongest oligarchy that you could think of, the Tsar and everything. And here, 1905, Isadora Duncan wrote when she saw them burying their dead by dawn. They couldn't even do it because it might awaken too much sympathy, and how she felt about it. And here, 12 short years later, where was that Tsar now? And I thought it was one of the greatest things.
Well, Barbara, backtracking a little bit before the Russian Revolution, one of the big disappointments, I think, for most radicals around the First World War was the expectation that the workers and the socialists internationally would not fight.
That's true.
That was
one of the great disappointments. I thought that if the socialists in Germany could go ahead and invade Belgium and go ahead and fight carrying on a capitalist war, only Liebknechte, only a few people who stood out and voted against the credit. That was a great disappointment. That was like a fly at the thing, you know, that if socialists could do that, what are you going to expect of the capitalist? That was a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, during those early years when you were married and when you were socialist and involved in that activity, say up to the Russian Revolution, how did it affect your life in terms of your marriage and how you raised your children, and how did it, as a woman, how you related to other people?
Well, in many ways, for one thing, in my house, my children were influenced very much by the songs. I've always thought the songs, the revolutionary songs, to me were just absolutely marvelous. And when we went into the war, the head of the Red Cross, Mrs. Evans, I belong to the parent teachers, came and asked how many of us would volunteer to go down and roll bandages and everything. Now, see, I wouldn't say anything to her until she came over to me and said, "How about you? You can't go. You have to." I said, "Mrs. Evans, it would be difficult because I have three small children, but if necessary, I could go, but I won't." And she said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I don't believe in war. I believe war is only a legal killing and a murder. And I will not join in anything to send the boys over there to need the bandages. I will not." She says, "Hush, it's too late now. We're in it." I said, "It's never too late to be against murder." And she says, "I should report you, but I won't." But the thing is, and I was scared to death, but I felt that I would be unworthy of my son if I didn't speak up and tell her why I wouldn't go. And I remember that I was scared to death. And I had a German neighbor who was afraid to speak and everything because they called her children names and everything. And then the president of the local parent teachers, she and Mrs. Huber, my neighbor, were walking down and they stopped to talk because they lived in the same neighborhood. And I thought, sure, they were going to call me down for saying anything. Instead of that, the president of the parent teacher said to me, "Mrs. Rosenblum, did you know that I was of German parentage?" I says, "No, Mrs. Swain, I didn't." So she said, "You know, I didn't dare to say what you said, but I was so glad you said what you did. Because I said," she said, "I'm German, but all the Germans are not going ahead and cutting off women's breasts, you know how they did." And Dorothy Canfield Fisher, who was one of my favorite women writers, you know, women novelists, had written in France they had the Hall of Prostitution, and it was literally that, she said, for there they had papier-mâché figures where they photographed them as if they were the real thing, showing a soldier was cutting off a woman's breast, and one was and everything, and all of it was just propaganda to get us to go into it.
Now, were you one of the few outspoken people, or was that whole group of socialists fairly outspoken?
Yes,
against the war?
Yes.
Did you hold actual demonstrations?
Yes, we had. Yes, we did. We had demonstrations. Of course, we had to run sometimes for shelter, you know, but it wasn't until the horrible things that happened in 1919.
In San Francisco.
That was still in Denver when they happened the riots. When they took people into jail and everything. That famous thing where they went ahead and through socialists in jail and...
During the Palmer raid, you mean?
Yes, the Palmer raid. But you don't have any idea how horrible those things really were. you know. See, one of the things that just made me absolutely ill was Ludlow. See, when we read about the strikers in Ludlow and what happened to them, you don't know what the picket lines are well about that. And the name of Rockefeller was the most hated in the world. No Rockefeller could have gotten a job as a dog catcher, much less anything else, you know, and everything. And when we went in 1921, before that, we went down to Ludlow and I showed the children they have made a hole, you know, where they lie buried, and told them, I said, never forget Ludlow. Remember what
now,
happened.
Did your group in Denver, were you able to do anything at the time of the strike in of the miners to actively support them?
Yes, well, most of the thing that we gave was raised money for them. That's most of the thing.
But you didn't go to the striking area before the Ludlow Massacre?
Well, the striking area was not in Denver. The striking area was in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
But we did send someone there.
Well, when you mentioned picketing before, were these industrial enterprises in Denver that you would...
Yes. They picketed even the stockyards, you know, because they were sending food from there and everything. And most of it was really, more than I remember of anything else in the picket line there, was in the socialist German, it was really a kind of a sports thing, you know, where they had it. And most of the picketing and most of the meetings took place there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Barbara, what I'd like to do is just get a few dates for the later period so that we can then decide how to proceed during that. You then came, the Communist Party was formed in 1919. And you joined in 1919.
Yes.
And when it was first formed in California, I know there were two groups. There was the Communist Labor Party and the Communist Party.
And see, we were still in Denver at that mm-hmm. time. And we had sent, as one of the delegates, the secretary of the socialist group by the name of George Intiman, whom I knew well, who was a close friend, and everything. He was one of the delegates sent to Chicago to form the at that time, I think it was called the Communist Labor Party,
right.
And everything. And he came back to make a report at the home of Will Dietrich, who was called the Denver Lenin, and everything. We used to live all together in a kind of a commune for about 6 months there.
That was in Denver. Okay,
and that time
that
Dorothy
really.
Was about three or four years old.
And you were still with
but it didn't work.
Then.
You were still what?
Your husband was with you too then?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
By that time he was working for the J.S. Hoffman Company, a Chicago cheese firm.
Okay.
And, but he was always very scared that we'd get into trouble, you know, and everything. And at that time, when the debates were going on in the Socialist Party too, you know. So then, you know, then the Palmer Raid came on, and you haven't any idea how horrifying that was. So Helen Dietrich, who was my closest friend, by that time we had moved out from that commune. It just wasn't the thing that I really cared for. Because the one who was the head of it, Dr. Hannon, who was the best teacher I ever met in my life of Marxism and everything. But nevertheless, they had three children too, you know. But I found it just didn't work.
How many families were in the commune?
How many there were? Only three families.
Three families. And how had you a specific
well,
plan?
Well, we pulled all our resources, and but the children fought, and taking aside, for instance, when Dorothy at that time was about 3 years old, and Eileen Hannon was the same age as she was, and she fought with Dorothy, and pulled her hair and everything. And Dorothy had been a kind of a sickly child, but of course she came after the Helen, my little girl, died, and for years I felt as if I was going to die after Helen died. So when Dorothy came in crying, I said, "Don't come and cry to me." I said, "The next time Irene does that, just pull her hair as hard as you can, or pick up anything and just let her have it too." And Minnie said, "Well, I wouldn't tell that to Irene." I said, "You don't have to. She fights without it." And everything. But I found out it just, you know.
So it wasn't mainly the problem between the children?
Well, to a great extent it was. Now with us, now see, we took turns. I hate cooking. Now see, Minnie Hannon cooked 1 week. Helen Dietrich was a very fine cook. She took the next one, and so I was supposed to. And planning meals and cooking, I didn't mind cleaning up. I didn't mind doing any of the work, but I hated planning meals and cooking.
So you all alternated each task.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, but the men played the usual men's roles. They did not get involved in the day-to-day running.
Well, you see, it had a kind of a celery patch that we were working all together, you know. So the men folks worked in that celery patch, you know, and we sold the celery, so it brought in some money. And at that time, then Helen had a few chickens, and then and most of the few eggs that were laid were eaten by the Hannons, but yet the Hannons protested about buying the chicken feed for the chicken. So altogether, it wasn't the pleasant.
Now, they were all socialists, though?
They were all socialists, mm-hmm. all socialists, and all joined the Communist Party. Now, Dr. Hannon really sailed under the false color, because we thought that he wasn't a real doctor, but that he was one of those naturopaths, mm-hmm. but he was a real doctor. And my son read about his, he was 6 years older than I was. And he was kind of a romantic figure to me, you know, because he taught the Communist Manifesto as no one has ever taught it before.
Now, is he the one, he's not the one who went to the convention in Chicago?
No, that was George Gentleman, the secretary of the Socialist mm-hmm. Party. He went, and do you know, when we didn't know how they got all the names. See, they had come when the Pomerates first started. Then we were told that by George Gentleman to bring out cards to the meeting and turn them over to him, and they were to be destroyed. So I said to Helen, "Helen, why should we bring it to him to be destroyed? If they have to be destroyed, can't we destroy them ourselves? I'm not going to bring mine to him." And she said, "Neither will I." So one day she said, "Someone has to go to the jail to see all those poor. There were so many foreign-born comrades." She said, "They are just must be just despairing of what's happening to them." So she went to see them, and that afternoon she came to my house. I lived in North Denver, with as white as death. And I said, "What's the matter? What happened?" She said, "Do you know who is the stool pigeon? Who turned in the names of all the people?" I said, "Who?" I said, "George Gentleman." I said, "That can't be. That can't be. The secretary of the Socialist Party who was present when the Communist Party was formed in your basement." I said, "But it is," she said. "You see, I went up to the federal building and I wanted to see the prisoners, so they said, go to there. And in the little anteroom, and there they will tell you where you can go and see whoever you want to see." So she said, "I came into the anteroom. Fortunately, I didn't knock right away. I came up, and as I stood there, I heard Intimate saying, 'Go after the foreign-born. They're scared to death.' And there I heard him telling the ones, you know, and everything, but only George Intimate knew that." So she said, "I knew that if I didn't want to get killed, because if they opened that door and saw me, I knew they'd kill me. There's no question of that. I came right over to your house." And there was a Hungarian woman communist staying at my house who came there, the worst place in the world, because already I was known as a very active person who engaged all this and everything, that always did offering my home or anything, you know, and people would come there. the worst place she was come to, but she didn't know anyone else. So she came to me and she was saying this. I said, Helen, where do I send Irene? And she said, well, she can't stay here. So she said, as I left as soon as I could, I was just afraid that I'd faint before I got out of the room. So when I met George Intiman, he had been a close friend. In Denver, there's what they call the loop, where the streetcars all come and make a circle. And I went there, you know, we used to get peanut butter there where they did it right into the jar. And George Intiman was there. And he came over to me. He said, Bobby, you don't really believe that. And I looked at him with the utmost contempt. I said, what else am I to believe? You don't believe that of me. I said, how is it they've got the name? He said, you see what I was doing? I was trying to commit those names to memory so I'd know afterward who to go to. And they came unexpectedly Saturday night as I had the names on the table. They came there. I said, isn't that strange? They came just then that you had all the names. He said, well, it just happened that way. I said, he said, you surely don't believe it. I said, yes, I surely do. And I walked away from him. He tried to come after me and talk to me, but I wouldn't talk to him.
Well, what did the socialists do then? Did everyone then simply ignore him?
Oh, yes, he was thrown out of the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had a meeting and revealed who it was who had done it, and they threw him out. And they were, you see, but he never had our books, so there was nothing he could do. Then neither Helen nor myself. But you know, people are funny, you know. Most of those brought their books, brought their cards to him. You know, I couldn't see any sense to that. If we were told to go ahead and destroy them, why did we have to bring it to him to destroy them? Why can't we just destroy them ourselves? We know they're destroyed.
Now, so the cell that was formed in Denver was of the Communist Labor Party first, right?
Yes.
And then what brought you out to, we'll get into more detail about that next time, but what then brought you out to California in 1921?
In 1921, it became the Communist Party.
And what brought you to California, though?
Well, Dorothy had been really a sickly child all the time. She'd had chilblains, and she had been very sick. She had had a mastoid infection, which she almost died. Oh, for 6 weeks, they didn't know that she'd live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had remembered California when I was a little girl when we came here, and the purple trees and everything, and I had loved California then, and the orange trees. And I always had a hankering and love to go. So, and Dorothy wasn't well, and I hated the snow. It gets awfully cold in Colorado. So we came then for mainly whole health,
mm-hmm.
but also to avoid these awful cold and everything.
Now, and your husband was still working as a waiter then, or did he?
No. By that time, he was already in Denver when he had begun working as a traveling salesman for the J.S. Hoffman Company, a Chicago firm dealing with cold meats. Mm-hmm. And
then when you moved out, what kind of work did he do?
He still did that.
I see.
He did that until he died. He was only 46 when he died.
When did he die?
In 1930. September the 20th, 1930.
So you lived from 1921 till his death up north?
We lived in 19. We came here in 1921, November the 17th. We left Denver in just a terrible snowstorm, and we stayed in Utah for 4 days at one of the hotels there, because Joe was. He would only be home 12 days and then be gone for 6 weeks. So he was staying there at that hotel. So we stayed there for 4 days with him. Then we came to Los Angeles. First we came to San Francisco. There was a little drizzle, but it was warm and everything. And I thought, well, this is heaven. I loved California.
So you stayed in Los Angeles, though?
Yeah, well, first we came to San Francisco, and that same night, you see, I had been a little girl when we came on the Pacific Ocean. all of the Atlantic, but I didn't remember it. And I had never seen the ocean. And I watched it with just bated breath as we left Oakland and came up. And the next day at 10 o'clock in the morning, we were in Los Angeles.
So then did you stay in Los Angeles for several years?
Yes.
Oh, because Anita Whitney was arrested in Oakland, wasn't she?
Yeah, we stayed in Los Angeles for, let me see. Well, really not very long, only about 6 months, and then we went to Oakland.
Oh, I see. Now, I'm just going to jump around here to get some dates. And then Rosenblum died in 1930.
Yeah.
And did you remarry right away, or did you marry Mr. Clinton?
I married almost 3 years later.
And he was...
A Bulgarian.
And he was in the Communist Party?
Well, he wasn't at that time. He joined in 1936. And he really was more a Tolstoyan than a communist. But I think the only reason that they deported him was to get because he was Dorothy's stepfather. Mm-hmm. Because he really, the most he ever did was go out into the people's world, and he wasn't very good at that.
Well, they actually did succeed in deporting him?
Well, you see, yes, they deported him, but he could have fought it yet if he'd wanted to. Mm-hmm. But you see what he thought. See, he had supported Dimitrov, you know, and everything. And Dimitrov was a Bulgarian. And he thought he wanted to go to Bulgaria and see what, and if the government was paying his expenses, he would get a chance to see there and see what was really happening, you know. Because, you know, right after the revolution in Bulgaria, they had killed also, that was the Stalin purge, you know, a great many of the top guys there. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that Stalin was a real son of a bitch. So he thought he would see, and then whenever he got ready, he would come back. And everyone told him, you'll never come back. That's how, you know, everyone who studies law, that's one of the things they study, that his case was the first one in history that they had taken away his Social Security because he was deported, because no one else did they ever do it from.
Now, what year was he deported then?
He was deported in 1956.
Hmm.
Right after Khrushchev's speech. Huh?
Is he still alive?
No, he's dead. He died over 2 years ago.
Were you still in contact with him?
Oh, yes. I wrote and sent him things all the time.
You were still married at the time he was deported.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Now, shortly after the Russian Revolution, did you go to the Soviet Union?
I never went to the Soviet Union.
Oh, you've never gone?
You know, it's a strange thing, isn't it? You know, I never even had any desire to go. For one thing, I don't know the language, and I do think, you know, the country I really loved was Mexico. I went with Helen Dietrich to Mexico, and I stayed there 2 weeks. And even names of have you ever been to Mexico?
Mm-hmm. I like it very much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love Mexico, and it was the funniest thing, you know, I met a black man in we went to the pyramids. And for 32 cents for the whole round trip, we went to, taking a train and a bus, we went to see a young black man was sitting next to me. I said, how long have you been in Mexico? He said, about 5 years. I said, do you like it? He says, it's the most freedom I've ever known. And I found the people really, they just charmed me. I, you know, those, the art, we went to the university there, and everything. And of course, we had a tremendous admiration for what was his name?
Rivera.
Yes, Rivera. And we had a young man. He took us out as a guide when we went to see the other cities close by, the little cities. And I said, I want to go to the home of the. He said, do you like Rivera? I said, yes, I do. I think he is a great artist and a great man. He said, well, you know, he's a communist. I said, well, is that against him? He said, well, the people here are Catholics. I said, they're not all Catholics. Are you a Catholic? He said, yes, but not a very, I don't really follow it too closely. I said, well, I said, but you do, yes. And you know, what we found out afterward, he took me to see the most beautiful works of Rivera, where the whole history of Mexico, you know, just absolutely magnificent. Where it shows where the Spanish came in and what they did with the sword and with the bonfires, how they converted the people. And I said to him, when we were going, look, I said, you talk about Rivera. Look at the works in there. He said, well, I thought you'd like that. And he wanted to take us to see that cathedral that's supposed to be like the basilica. And I said, no, I don't like to see people groveling in the on their knees walking. He says, look, there's been a revolution in that. Now they walk 1 mile. But one